We're excited to know more about the Ballad of Little Joe. You know, I could only see the trailer of the 1993 movie. I didn't get a chance to see the actual movie. But give us the little bit of the synopsis of the story of the Ballad of Little Joe.
25 years. Yeah. We started at the Public Theater. When this was in the piece, I think we met him when this was at the Prince Workshop. John came. And there was something about this story and this piece and a couple of the songs he had heard. And I think we only had about a half an hour of it then that just hooked him, and it wouldn't let him go. And he said it wasn't too long after that is when he made a promise to Josephine that he wouldn't forget her. So John has been a supporter of Sarah and I's work. We've done two other shows here, a small chamber musical called In This House, and a Christmas show in Wind in the Willows. So this is our third production here at Two River. It's post-Civil War, and so the soldiers were wandering, you know, mountains and areas and whatnot, brutalized by a couple of soldiers. And to hide from their further in their finding her, she disguised herself as a man, you know, for protection. And the curious thing, and no one knows why this is, she then proceeded to live the rest of her life that way. And now it's not a gender issue. This was a woman who disguised herself as a man. And perhaps the consideration would be she disguised herself to be what was necessary to be to get what you wanted, to survive in a very, very difficult time and a very challenging area, you know, brutal area time and time. And so she lived the rest of her life that way. So that's essentially what then they didn't know that Joe, Little Joe, they called him Little, he's an odd little man, this Little Joe, was actually Josephine until she died and they did an autopsy and found a few things missing. and that became a story, you know. And it's interesting in the census of the time, it's where you had to list the sex, you know, male or female on the census. Hers was listed as undetermined. Yeah, it's a really fascinating thing. So there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of area to wander in there and try to figure out why would a person do that? And that's what whether we succeeded or not, there are models that you put over the story, all human being, that are applicable to all. This is one person's life, but the model, whether it's James Joyce's monomyth or Joseph Campbell, the hero's journey, which is available to every human being, which is the journey to the deepest experience of your own life you can have. And in her case, you can't do that when you're pretending to be someone else. And eventually she comes, learns that through a character in the piece and eventually reclaims herself, in our piece anyway. There's a lot of wide open room to tell a story, and we've used that area to imagine what the reasons might have been.
Now, you adapted this from the movie that I mentioned, Susie Amos playing Little Joe. Those, of course, know composer James Cameron. That's James Cameron's wife. She is now an activist, no longer in the acting profession. But when did you decide the research into Little Joe to say, yeah, I want to get involved in this?
You know what? I got to be completely honest with you here. I hope I'm honest in everything I say. I'm not sure I would have chosen this. I had written a show with a fellow named Mac Perkle at Tennessee Repertory Theater in Nashville, based on the small family during the Civil War. And I learned from that experience writing a musical about the Civil War that the Civil War usually wins. we got it up, but it was not successful. I wouldn't have necessarily chosen this, but with the opportunity, it was chosen as part of a Hal Prince workshop. And so the opportunity, I was in New York working on a little one-act opera with my partner Sarah Schlesinger, and this opportunity came up that we would be in the Hal Prince workshop. And I imagine we probably thought at the time, maybe we'll get to rub elbows with Hal and he can become aware of our work. Whether or not I would have chosen this specifically, because it's not the traditional lightweight. There's humor in this piece. There's a lot of air in this piece, and there's a lot of humor, and I don't believe in badgering an audience for 2 hours in the theater. Nobody wants that. But it was an opportunity to work with Hal, and then we had to find our way through it. Say, okay, we wrote the one of the most difficult things we encountered was one of the very best songs that remains in the show today was the first song we wrote, and I remember thinking to myself, wow, that song is really. I never think this about my own things, but I thought if we can write a show that earns that moment, we might be onto something. So off we went, and it's been a long, interesting, circuitous route to get to where we are.
I know the people here at Two River Theater have been talking for a long time about the Ballad of Little Joe coming to the theater and have been very exciting. John D is here, directorial debut, so obviously, he feels something about this piece.
He's also a book writer. He came on as a book writer some years ago. And the musical theater, I think theater in general, but certainly musical theater. I've worked in opera, the world of opera and chamber music, country songs, pop songs. There's nothing more difficult. I can't think of anything that comes close to the difficulty of getting a musical right. And it's the most collaborative form I've ever experienced. You cannot do this on your own. Very few people. The music man, Meredith Wilson, he wrote the music book and the lyrics to that show. But that's pretty rare. It's an extremely collaborative art form. When John Diaz came into the project and became a book writer, the piece would not be what it is without John Diaz and his insight. So I at first was not 100% sure about a book writer directing, but this piece is so in John's body. He revealed to us in a very touching moment when we were getting ready to start rehearsals, that he said, Josephine Monaghan, he made a promise to her years ago that he would never forget her. And I was so touched by that. It was such a beautiful thing to say that at this point, and now we're weeks of rehearsal in, and there's no reason John shouldn't direct. He's finding the heart and center of the piece. And there's a young man named Mark Kimmelman who's putting, he's a choreographer putting action and body movement into the piece that's adding a dimension it's never had before. So, you know, I get to stand on the sidelines and hand the music over to a music director and see if it works or not.
I know you'd mentioned that it was a survival mode for her to change, you know, and basically portray herself as a man. But do you think maybe after spending time as a man, she could have possibly felt that that was who she really should be?
That's not addressed in the piece. That's a very, very fair question. These are the things we don't know. You know, she didn't write anything to let anyone know exactly why she did what she did. But she lived for decades as a man, so she must have, you know, there had to be a time where she thought, yeah, this is how. I would also imagine in the town of Silver City where it takes place that she got in rather, I would guess, rather quickly in over her head and to announce to these, and keep in mind, this was a tough, brutal tents and cabins, shanty mining town. These were not your, you know, new age people, you know, with lots of gentler insights. These were hard Scrabble times. So perhaps she got in over her head and thought, well, I can't reveal who I am now at this point. But it is a curious thing. She had a relationship with a young Chinese man out there who had originally been there to assist in building the railroads, and that eventually she had a relationship with him. Now how deep it went, again, there's nothing written about it, so she never revealed to anyone. But she certainly had interaction with that man that no one else knew about.
Mike Reed goes all out in his music, and his music is the Ballad of Little Joe, the musical that's here at Two River Theater running from June 3rd to the 26th. One of the outstanding musicals that has played here in the past is Be More Chill, and one of the actors who was one of the stars is in this show. Let's talk about the cast of your wonderful musical.
I don't think this piece was done in London at the Bridewell. It was a beautiful cast of English and Scottish actors, a small production, very passionate. Actors tend to just, when they discover this story, they tend to hurl themselves. I mean, you've never seen anything like a group of actors who are committed to a piece. They really might be my single favorite group of people. Individually, they're interesting to deal with, but as a group, to see a group of actors commit to a piece is incredible. I really do believe, as much as I appreciate every time this piece has been done, it was done in Chicago at the Steppenwolf Theater some years ago, I don't believe it'll ever be sung. It's never been sung as well as it's going to be sung here. Jane Bruce, Eric Morris, and Teal Wicks, the three major, are just major principal characters, all sing and act on a level that is, I think, as an ensemble, is very rare. I think it's very rare for me. They have just climbed inside this music, and it's a strange thing that the level of their musicianship is extraordinary. It's not just about singing notes, singing the words, remember the words, and singing the notes. They all have a level of musicianship, of how to phrase, how to backphrase. Backphrasing, we don't want to be too technical. Backphrasing would be, here's the ultimate backphraser, would be Willie Nelson, when he sings a little behind the beat, a little lag. When the front of the beat is where all the urgency is. So when you want to create urgency, you sing the front of the beat. When you want to find the emotion, you sing in the back half of the beat. You can't always teach that. And all three of these people do this instinctively. So there's enormous emotion in what they're doing. But the touching thing, their intonation, which is, can you sing in tune? Their intonation is immaculate. I wonder if they even know how to sing out of tune. And they've just connected with these characters. So I'm getting to hear this music in a way I never have before, on a level which is not to say I don't deeply appreciate what has come before. But whatever the life of this piece is, I will leave Red Bank knowing that I've heard it as I... Well, not only as I heard it in my head, but maybe even beyond what I heard in my head.
Our theater critic Michael Bourne says, you want to be humming a song as you leave the theater. What song are we leaving humming?
Oh, what a great question. What a wonderful question. That's a tough one. I am by nature, I must tell you, and it goes counter to a little bit of contemporary music. Historically, at different times, contemporary popular music will be driven by different things. By that, I mean, if you look at, let's go to Showboat, 1929, the father of the popular song Jerome Kern. Up through the 30s, you had the Gershwins, Richard Rodgers in the 40s with Oklahoma. You couldn't be a songwriter then if you couldn't write a melody. You had to, songwriting was predominantly great lyrics and great melodies. Rock and roll came along and made it about a primal sort of tribal anarchy. Turn it up, loud as you can go, play these three chords and sing these, you know, Rock Around the Clock. And then Dylan comes, you know, and became, out of Dylan and Paul Simon in the 60s, became James Taylor and Joni Mitchell, a level of literacy in the lyrics, you know. We're in a period now in popular music where it is primarily driven by rhythm. Rhythm drives most of what you hear in popular music, which makes it a great experience at the moment, but it makes rhythm also can make it difficult for a melody to carry any of the weight of the piece. So, and I'm not down on today's music. I love a lot of it, but I do find it find its principal motor is rhythm more than the lyric idea or more than a melodic content. That's the great thing about Adele, though, that she brings melody back to the party, you know, a little bit. And I am by nature, and can't change this, a melody writer. I think melodically, I think harmonically. When I think harmonically, I think of atmosphere, particularly in theater, where you say, okay, the characters in this particular kind of jam is in this particular, has this problem. What is the sound of that? What would this emotional sound of that particularly emotional problem be? And I find that. And then melody's pretty much instinctive. You know when it's flat, you know when it's flaccid, you know when it's boring. If it bores you, there's no reason to think it's not going to bore everyone else. That's a long-winded, I hope you're going to edit these answers, because I can't seem to, you ask such marvelous questions, I can't seem to shut up. I hope there are four or five things in the show, you know. I'm by nature a melody writer, I pay attention to melody, and there's a mining song, when the miner's on the hillside, you know, trying to find the silver, high, low, high. Listen to the Rain is a song between Josephine and Tianmen, the Chinese man. When you love someone, Jordan sings. Teal does a sensational job of singing a song called Unbuttoning the Buttons when Josephine reveals herself to be a woman. Obviously, I'm struggling for an answer. It's a great question. Maybe we should be outside the theater and ask and see the, as they file out, see if they're humming anything other than, you know, I hate that show. I hope they're not humming that.
I'm sure they won't be. We're speaking with Mike Reed. So we're here. I like to call it the Clue Room. Cassie's going to always laugh because I mentioned this that when we have these interviews here at Two River Theater, because it reminds me of the game with the Clue Room. And
Does. Right? It does, completely. Oh, I wasn't connecting. Mr. Mustard.
Exactly.
In a library with a wrench.
There you go. Yeah. Exactly. So little Jo Monahan comes back to life, and she takes my place. What do you want to ask her?
Well, that's a fantastic question. I would ask her, why did you do this? What were you thinking? What was your reason for living your life as you did? We all have that. We all can choose, have the right to choose how we live, what we do with our lives. We can't choose when we live them. I would like to ask her why she did what she did.
Cassie Galassetti is who I'm talking about. She's sitting here in the Clue Room at Two River Theater. The show is The Ballad of Little Jo, and not only it's the directorial debut for John Diaz here, and your relationship, then, you've known each other for quite some time.
John and Sarah and I have known each other 25 years. Yeah. We started at the Public Theater. When this was in the piece, I think we met him when this was at the Prince Workshop. John came, and there was something about this story in this piece and a couple of the songs he had heard, and I think we only had about a half an hour of it then, that just hooked him, and it wouldn't let him go. And he said it wasn't too long after that is when he made a promise to Josephine that he wouldn't forget her. So John has been a supporter of Sarah and I's work. We've done two other shows here, a small chamber musical called In This House, and a Christmas show in Wind in the Willows. So this is our third production here at Two River.
The amazing Mike Reed. What a pleasure it has been to sit down with you.
I'm so sorry to be so long-winded, but you ask such wonderful, and I don't get interviewed, you know, the way I used to. So you ask such marvelous questions, and I hope you have a good editing thumb there. You can cut this up and use it as you see fit.
We're just going to let it roll, Mike.
Well, you're very kind. Thank you.